Figured out I was muted there, and I forgot. I recorded them two songs, and I muted my microphone to record those songs. So welcome, everybody, to another Tuesday afternoon on Shake and Wake Radio. The show is called Cancel the Cabal, and in case anybody doesn't know, that was my Revolution Radio intro. I had a friend that cut out the Revolution Radio and Freedom Slips Presents, and then it cut to Cancel the Cabal, because I wasn't on Revolution Radio anymore, but I still liked the intro and still used it. This is Tuesday, as I mentioned, on Shake and Wake Radio, and also on PSN Radio, EPGN Radio, and SoFlo Radio. So if everybody is able to, please donate to those stations. Yeah, it's a cool intro, Annie. So is the other one, too. But if you're able to donate, please help Annie out. I know she could really appreciate it. She has bills come up every single month, like everybody does, like I do. I'm going to continue on reading Sexual Sabotage, How One Mad Scientist Unleashed a Plague of Corruption and Contagion on America, by Dr. Judith Reisman. I think that was pretty much her entire life's work, was trying to expose Alfred Kinsey and what he did in the 40s and 50s, and what we're still dealing with today. I think I will go back about half a paragraph to go over last week's reading. In 2007, teen wire entries included a girl who just had an abortion, someone with hepatitis wondering about infecting her boyfriend, and similar stories. Planned Parenthood's experts never changed their tune, just prescribed lots of sex, condom use, and big pharma when the time comes. Planned Parenthood operates several similar websites that children worldwide can visit. One such is scarlteen.com. It's back to school for you and back to the basics here at Scarlteen. How about adding some sexuality primers from our articles, blog, and advice answers to your do-it-yourself sex ed course load this year? Do you have your prerequisites on sexual orientation? We've got the B's and the B's, a homosexuality and bisexuality primer for you thinking about coming out this year. Here's the guide on how to come out of the closet without tripping over your laundry. Scarlteen.com. Planned Parenthood brags under the heading, "The information and education you need to help find you, to help find the you in sexuality." Many of the textbooks that are used in public school sex education classes in 1999 would have been considered pornographic or obscene 20 to 30 years ago. Most people using kinky to refer to sexual behavior, considered abnormal in the society, a value judgment, not a definition. That does not mean they are normal. They are abnormal. However, not too long ago, oral sex was considered abnormal or deviant, as was masturbation, mutual masturbation, anal sex, and more. Many people use the term kinky to describe themselves proudly. In another entry, a teen allegedly writes, "Dear experts, I look at porno sites, but I got all, but I got all A's. I got all A for my subjects. People say looking at these sites affect your schoolwork. Since I think I'm not affected, should I stop it? If I should, how? Answered, Planned Parenthood deliberately dodges the pesky problem that obscenity is illegal for everyone and pornography is illegal for minors. They reply, pornography, also known as porn or porno, is sexually arousing imagery. Some people prefer to call it erotica, because the word pornography is sometimes used to describe material that may be considered offensive and obscene. In any case, many people enjoy using pornography or erotica as a part of their sexual play, alone or with a partner. Extensive pornography details omitted here. There is no indication that using pornography causes problems as long as it does not interfere with other aspects of a person's life. Hope this information helps. Ongoing and systemic promotion of teen sex. In 2004, Planned Parenthood published a pornographic comic book, It's Perfectly Normal, for fifth to ninth graders. That year, they sold more than 1 million copies of Sexual Sabotage. That year, they sold 1 million copies of The Sexual Sabotage, assorted sex acts, and full frontal nudity, largely of pubescent children, fully illustrated. It would not be out of place on the walls of a ruined Roman brothel in Pompeii. or Sodom and Gomorrah. Famed advice columnists and Landers hailed It's Perfectly Normal as a great book, saying that children would enjoy the pictures. To this statement, the Christian conservative author Lee Duigen replied, and has apparently been hanging around the Kinsey Institute crowd, which thinks child molestation is just part of a good scientific inquiry into sex. Elsewhere, Duigen writes, did you know that the anus is a sex organ? Did you know that the one and only reason people object to homosexuality is because their views are often based on misinformation, not on facts? Or that although some religions call masturbation a sin, the fact is that masturbation cannot hurt you, and that abortion is always right if the baby is unwanted. As it turns out, extreme abuse of one's sex organs can induce massive trauma. And as we saw with Kinsey, much worse, as children followed Planned Parenthood's sex prescription, the organization opened neighborhood clinics to handle a booming business. The organization aborted millions of babies in these clinics still. Planned Parenthood offered no aid to women whose breast cancer might be traced to those abortions, or to women dying from AIDS or cervical cancer, or any other promiscuity-based diseases. All direct results of Planned Parenthood's rigorously advanced sexual freedom. I had heard that women that did have abortions had 26 times more, 26 times more of getting cervical cancer than women that did not. Indeed, a pattern of lying to school children dominates Planned Parenthood's advice in government-sanctioned, tax-subsidized obscenity and pornography. In Brave New World, Aldous Huxley said the state could control the people if it could train school children to have sex. In 1984, George Orwell writes that the state could control the people by giving them pornography. Both were on target, Thomas Sowell said. The techniques of brainwashing are routinely used in psychological conditioning programs imposed on American school children. These include emotional shock and desensitization, stripping away defenses, and inducing acceptance of alternate values. This description well defines the Rockefeller-funded Kinsey attack on the greatest generation's morals. This is vividly displayed in the 1974 Rocky Mountain Planned Parenthood booklet, You've Changed the Combination, which shocked and desensitized ninth grade students with pornographic drawings of nude, Playboy-style, large-breasted women towering over wimpy, nude males, drawn without genitalia, that is, visually castrated. You've Changed the Combination warned naive boys and girls that parents who fear homosexuality force boys into becoming heterosexual. Your parents do not want you to be homosexual, the manual states. So they begin to focus you on girls sexually about the time you hit puberty, brutally desensitizing impressionable boys. The authors instruct them to reject girls. Who expected boys to become, to open doors for them, pay the cost of an invited date, or to proffer their gentlemanly curtsies? Such girls, the pamphlet said, are not advanced. However, the good news is that a new study, Dr. John and Loretta Gemmett of the University of Pennsylvania, that joins a long list of evaluations demonstrating the effectiveness of abstinence education. Robert Rector, senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, confirmed the new study supports 11 of 15 studies, finding abstinence programs effective on reducing sexual activity. The Gemmett study finds that not only is real abstinence education highly effective in reducing youthful sexual activity, but that the safe sex and comprehensive sex ed programs addressed above are counterproductive. Chapter 10, Abortion Educator Saboteurs. I fear the power of choice over life or death at human hands. I see no human being whom I could ever trust with such power, not myself nor any other. Human wisdom, human integrity are not great enough. Since the fetus is a creature alive, already alive and in the process of development, to kill it is to choose death over life. At what point shall we allow this choice? At no point, I repeat, either as life begins or as life ends, for we who are human beings cannot, for our own safety, be allowed to choose death, life being all we know. Novelist Pearl S. Buck. Kinsey's amazing data on abortion. 3 years after Kinsey's death, his disciples acknowledged that there was a dearth of factual data on the reproductive consequences of human sexuality, on births or abortions among married or unmarried females. So they said they would provide this much-needed factual information. The result was Kinsey's posthumous third volume, Pregnancy, Birth, and Abortion, published by Kinsey Institute Director Paul Gebhardt and colleagues in 1958. Gebhardt's report detailed Kinsey's magical findings, which he had allegedly recorded about abortion and contraception that his bogus female subjects used. While his amazing information exists nowhere in Kinsey's first two volumes, the elite academic and legal professions accepted pregnancy, birth, and abortion at face value. The true agenda of the eugenic Keynesians was to encourage abortion among lower-income, minority, and feeble-minded women. To do so, they ignored the realities of Keynes's study population and argued in pregnancy, birth, and abortion that their study population approximated the socioeconomic upper 20% of the urban population. Though they acknowledged that this group might include an overrepresentation of women who had been separated, divorced, or widowed. In fact, it included an overrepresentation of prostitutes, whom he disguised in his data as normal married women, Susie Homemaker and Rosie the Riveter. The documentation of these interviews is off limits to anyone but Kinsey Institute insiders. To this day, no one has ever verified Kinsey's numbers. But among these elite white women, they claimed between 1/4 and 1/5 had an induced abortion. And of premarital pregnancies that ended before marriage, 6% were live births, 5% spontaneous abortions, 89% induced abortions. So only after Kinsey's death did his successors suddenly produce the statistics that 89% of single pregnant women and 25% of married pregnant women had aborted their babies. So popular, allegedly, was illegal abortion in America during World War II, even though in wartime women usually cling desperately to their children or fathers, to the children of fathers whom may never return. In fact, this was zero science here. Abortion is a big business. As millions of women have created and terminated babies, emotions run high for and against legalized abortion. How can they do that? Pro-life activists view the killing of a child in the womb as a murder of an innocent life. On the other side of the debate, pro-abortion activists call unborn babies fetuses, lumps of tissue, and parasites. They are adamant that women have the legal right to kill them. After all, the unborn, they claim, feel no pain. So women are trained to distance themselves from the growing human being in their bodies as they fall prey to barbaric schemes unimaginable to women of the greatest generation. Yes, Mom, it's angering. Once abortion was legalized, Planned Parenthood clinics were a gold mine. To abort babies, they built an entire industry with facilities, pharmaceuticals, pills, potions, therapeutic services, and medical professionals. In the economics of abortion, the earlier girls had sex, especially unmarried girls, the more babies and the more would need to be aborted. And by 1971, Big Pharma and Big Sexology got their hands on millions of children in the healthcare system. But by 1976, heeding the outraged roar of a residual moralistic American public, Congress cut federal Medicaid funds for abortions, except in cases of life endangerment, rape, and/or incest. No free abortions for casual promiscuity. Nonetheless, thanks to the sexual revolution, sexual promiscuity increased. and the profits for Big Pharma and Big Sexology increased exponentially anywhere. Sex, after all, was like cigarettes. The sooner children started having sex or smoking, the greater the probability they would be permanent pawns of the sex and or cigarette, alcohol, drug industries. And that was good for business. At first, the abortions themselves were the moneymaker for Planned Parenthood and other abortion mills. But in time, as medical technology advanced, a great deal of money could be made by actual selling of lump of tissue in the whole or in parts. In partial birth abortion, the so-called physician pulls a live baby feet first from his or her mother's what? From his or her mother's womb. Are they getting into this trans 10 years ago? Is that what she's getting into? And then he stabs the infant through the back of the skull to kill him or her. Oh, I see. Okay. Boy or male or female baby. For many of us, it is difficult to believe that this is legal in the United States of America. But this grisly operation is performed all over the country by doctors who swore to uphold the Hippocratic Oath. Partial birth abortion, however, is preferable to the alternative. Dilatation and evacuation, D&E. In D&E, the physician inserts an instrument into the womb to kill the baby. According to Life Dynamics, this method delivers pieces of macerated organs that are usually unsuitable for fetal research, transplantation, etc. This may be the main reason for pro-abortionist vehement defense of the practice of partial birth abortion. Partial birth abortion is in which most of the baby is aborted intact, is most profitable. This is why the sex industry complex lobbies so hard to maintain the legal right to do it. How could Americans have come to the brutal mass murder of infants, sacrificing children for profit? The psychological Kinsey sect deserves some credit. The Kinsey lobby and the SIC worked for decades to solidify the sexual revolution, promoting promiscuity and fighting legal rights on everything from obscenity to abortion. They pushed us down the slippery slope, such as the Greatest Generation, looking down from the peak, would scarcely recognize their own descendants or the culture in which they live. Because women have become responsible for both conceiving and destroying their babies, and because women are now trained to distance themselves from the children in the wombs, too many can and do fall prey to violence unimaginable to women of the Greatest Generation. Although human cloning is still on the drawing board, Big Pharma finds it especially valuable to harvest baby parts from late-term abortions. The growing human trafficking in children now also includes embryonic body parts. It is unconscionable to pretend that entrepreneurs are not already using embryonic researchers as customers. A marketing opportunity for profitable global trade in body parts, including embryonic stem cells. According to the National Right to Life website, embryonic stem cells are taken from aborted fetuses or clinically produced embryos. Adult stem cells are obtained from born children or adults. To date, research using embryonic stem cells has not had favorable results. While that using adult stem cells have been been very positive. Research cloning involves cloning human embryos for purposes such as pulling stem cells, after which the embryos die. Reproductive cloning involves allowing the cloned embryo to grow and be born. From embryonic stem cell research to cloning and other fetal experiments, where does our science establishment draw the line? Question mark. In H.G. Wells' 1896 novel, The Island of Dr. Moreau, a medical researcher creates an island of human-animal hybrids, leopard men, and swine folk. Frighteningly, 100 years later, life imitates art. Modern researchers use in vitro manipulation, inserting embryonic cells from one species into the blastocyst of another. The resulting creature has the features of both species. It is indeed a brave new world. I think I'll take the break right here. First break. Let's see. A couple short songs, I think. Guess we'll be back in about 5.5 minutes, everyone. Okay. My voice was fine a minute ago, and then it started choking up on me. Welcome back, everyone. Science aside, the killing of children inside the womb naturally mastitized into violating and even killing children outside the womb. The next step, then, is that in addition to permitting mothers and doctors to kill unborn babies, we approve the violating and killing other people, as the Incas and other prior civilizations did through their child sacrifice. The evidence shows that maintaining a civilization depends on the severest of restraints, which must be found in our laws. For the law is our teacher, codifying our ideals, if not always our actions. So what then if authorities decide it is legitimate to kill brain-damaged people, whom the elitists first dehumanized as vegetables? That same society will eventually find it acceptable and even prudent to kill the sick, the old, and other burdensome people. Once it gets a degree of societal freedom, evil knows no bounds. That the legalization of abortion revolutionizes America's social and moral order is agreed. We might also legitimately see the selling of infant body parts as exchanging the Judeo-Christian moral view from a neo-pagan moral view. We would do well to remember that this exchange has consequences. Taxpayers fund Planned Parenthood's sexual sabotage. American taxpayers gave Planned Parenthood more than $1.49 billion in the 7 years after June 30, 1997. For what? ? Planned Parenthood admits that it performs over 1,398,574 abortions from 1997 to 2003, with profits of $350 million. Government grants and contracts continue to be a large and growing portion of Planned Parenthood's revenue, growing from $165 million in 1997-98 to more than $265 million in 2003-04, and $272 million in 2007. The STOPP chart reflects Planned Parenthood Federation of America yearly abortion profits from 1997 to 2003, based upon an estimated average cost of an abortion in each year. The PPFA would have earned roughly $985 million from aborting babies during 1977. Through 2002. Planned Parenthood's sabotage of the unborn started even earlier. Babies were not sweet little things, said the PPFA. FA's five-year plan. From 1975 to 1980, they met and dirtied themselves. I'm going to start that over. Said the FPAA's five-year plan. For 1975 to 1980, they wet and dirtied themselves. They get sick, and they're very expensive to take care of. Emphasis shall be put on services to teenagers and young adults. Unwanted pregnancy should be considered a sexually transmitted condition of epidemic proportion, wrote David A. Grimes, and Willard Gates Jr. Association of Planned Parenthood Physicians, APPF. In the 1976 article, they added legal abortion is an effect safe, is an effective, safe, and curative treatment for that condition. Abortion as a treatment for unwanted pregnancy, the number two sexually transmitted disease. I didn't know that pregnancy was a condition. I didn't really. I guess that's how they substantiate a lot of things, calling it a condition or a parasite or anything but a baby. More than 20 years later, according to Gloria Felt, then president of the PPFA, Planned Parenthood, has taken unequivocal and courageous stands, working for minors' access to abortion and contraception, and leading the way for abortion. Sad but true. In fact, Planned Parenthood and Big Pharma are leading the way in profiting from abortion, venereal disease treatment, and vaccines for sexual disease. This profit depends upon increasing juvenile sexual promiscuity. Without massive teen fornication, Planned Parenthood would shrink drastically. Hence, since the late 60s, Planned Parenthood has disguised titillating Kinsey-based sex training as sex education for the benefit of millions of schoolchildren. Not surprisingly, with billions of government grants and contracts over the last decades, Planned Parenthood invested millions in classroom promiscuity training, using our money to lie to our youth and to do them fatal harm. In Making a Bloody Future, Kelly Hollowell, MD, asked why Planned Parenthood's raunchy teen outreach website, teenwire.com, taught teenagers the nutritional value of semen. Also provided by another teen advisor, Go Ask Alice, along with the calorie content of serving of a man's ejaculation. Expert Alice doesn't suggest any negatives in the girl's consumption of sperm, nor her age or the word man, not boy, to describe her partners. Alice is encouraging sperm is low in calories, important to youngsters these days. She adds the gulping gallons a day isn't a substitute for a real nutrition cuisine. The review of both advice sites finds training for anal sex, oral sex, and orientation experimentation. Sex ed shocked and disturbed teens. By the 1980s, Planned Parenthood's sex education lectures were often crudely pornographic. George Grant's Grand Illusion, The Legacy of Planned Parenthood, details important testimonies by girls who sat through a Planned Parenthood presentation on sex, contraception, pregnancy, and abortion. Grant writes, "Catherine told me later, I've never seen pornography before. After the speaker passed a condom package to each girl and told the boys to hold up a finger so that the girls could practice contraceptive application, The shell-shocked students followed orders. As the class ended, some of the girls quietly cried. One ran out and vomited, and another fainted. One girl reported that a peer training project had filled her mind with all sorts of obscene ideas, pushed her into sex, and forced her into an abortion. In the end, she hated what she'd become. Children's emotions are delicate and complex. Indeed, Catherine said one girl committed suicide. According to Grant, Planned Parenthood's Lewis Harris 1986 National Opinion Survey found that more than 87%, you know, these, I'm really surprised that girls didn't, girls and boys just didn't walk out and not want any part of it. I don't know. More than 87% of surveyed teens opposed in-school comprehensive sexuality services. 67% said they didn't want such services near their schools. 28% said they had had sexual intercourse. Almost all who had intercourse blamed peer pressure. Nearly 80% said they were too young to have intercourse. Planned Parenthood, though, did not listen to its own study. On an endless mission to force promiscuity on American youth, the organization does not care about venereal infections and abortions or depression and suicide. Suicides would go right along with their agenda. The teens in the poll admitted that their comprehensive sex education courses had affected their behavior. Grant wrote, there were 50% higher rate of sexually active activity for them after the classes. Sadly, their understanding of the consequences of such activity were not correspondingly enhanced. I'm reminded the same reaction of teenagers to the subtly progress film strip. Marijuana update. Progress film strip. Marijuana update. I never heard that one. After it was screened by the health teacher at Shaker Heights High School in the 1970s, one youth reported to me, my friends left saying they were going to get high. I just thought about it. The movie industry has influenced youth a lot. It was in the 40s and 50s when they made them biker gang movies, and 60s and 70s. There was biker gangs that came out. Bruce Lee and Chuck Norris movies. Boys went and got violent after them movies came out. Claude Van Damme movies too. Just people imitated the violence from Hollywood. And of course from the Kinsey book and Playboy and all of this, the porn industry. People just seem to imitate it. Why? I do not know. Preying upon school children, Planned Parenthood and the SIECUS are but two of several evil, fraudulent, occult-like sex education programs that perpetuate the Kinseyan sexual revolution model. Their barbaric sexperts have been educating our children for more than half a century. Sadly, if they measure their success in pandemic childhood venereal disease, abortion, suicide, homicide, rape, child sexual abuse, depression, and despair, they have succeeded. That's what I said just a few minutes ago. Despite the horror stories, it is a miracle that some American youths retain their chastity, decency, and sensitivity. We should thank them and their parents. Yes, it does, Andy. It goes back to the silent films. Sexual abuse of students explodes. Those who think that educators, especially female teachers, cannot be pedophiles and pederasts, have not been paying attention. Such naivete has cost millions of children their innocence. Today we have an epidemic of direct violation of children by educators. Men and women, post-Kinsey with pornography, post-Kinsey with pornography addiction running rampant, many teachers and other academic professionals have been convicted of internet child pornography and other child abuse crimes. And schools and public libraries have increasingly housed predators, authorities who are dangerous to girls and boys. According to the 2004 Education Week report, Hofstra University Professor Charles Shakeshaft, well, that's a heck of a name, reviewed published research examining previous studies on educator sexual misconduct. A synthesis of existing literature, Shakeshaft concluded that the physical sexual abuse of students in schools is likely more than 100 times the abuse by priests. And no wonder our schools are filled with teachers who are sexually trained. As we, many Catholic seminaries, by Kinseyan sex educators, millions of children might be victims of sexual misconduct by such eroticized teachers and other public school and library employees. Shakeshaft reports that school employees targeted roughly 10% of children with unwanted sexual attention, from libidinous remarks to rape. In 2003, a 2003 report by Gretchen Timmerman supports Shakeshaft's findings. Timmerman found that a stunning 20% of girls and 8% of boys had been sexually harassed by an adult in school. Additionally, in the survey of high school graduates, 17.7% of males and 82.2% of females reported sexual harassment by faculty or staff during their school careers. 13.5, I gotta find my place now. Thirteen point five percent of those surveyed said they had engaged in sexual intercourse with a teacher. Several other studies confirm that sexual harassment in secondary schools is widespread, a frequent public occurrence in the school culture. Survivors of educator sexual abuse and misconduct emerge. Oh, Sesame. That's what they have an acronym for that. Survivors of education sexual abuse and misconduct emerge. Sesame. S-E-S-A-M-E. While judges, prosecutors, and doctors have been convicted of child sexual abuse, the great majority of child predators seek out paid or volunteer positions that give them legitimate, easy access to children in schools, libraries, and churches, and as music teachers, coaches, youth leaders, etc. Survivors of educator sexual abuse and misconduct emerge is an organization of educator abuse victims and their families, organized to inform Americans about the toxic fallout from giving unquestioned authority to those in possessions of educational guidance over children. Sesame provides a voice for the prevention of sexual exploitation, abuse, and harassment of students by teachers and other school staff, pointing to the predatory subset of the teaching population. Sesame documented that sexual assault of children is not uncommon among educators, including those in schools and public libraries. Sesame reported, "The best estimate is that 15% of students will be sexually abused by a member of the school staff during their school career. Many abusers are in positions of power or trust in relation to the victim, which makes it easier to overcome a child's resistance." Well, I think I'm going to take a little break here. And I might play a few extra songs. My dinner is ready, and I almost lost my spot. My dinner is ready. I think I might play a few extra songs and have a little dinner. I'm getting a little hungry right now, and I don't know how long it's going to be. I'm just going to put some songs on. The first one is going to be about 8.5 minutes. I think a lot of us have heard this. Whitley Phipps, Amazing Grace. So, be back soon.
This has been an awesome night, isn't it, everyone? This one. How many of you like Negro spirituals? An old black lady down south showed me something about the Negro spirituals, and I want to share it with you. You know, the black folk down south had more sense by accident than some of us have on purpose. You know what I mean? You didn't hear what I said. I heard an old black lady say, "Son, if the mountain was smooth, you couldn't climb it." Think about that for a minute. But did you know, she said to me, "Did you know just about all Negro spirituals are written on the black notes of the piano?" This is absolutely true. You can go home tonight and play almost any Negro spiritual, just play the black notes on the piano. You look skeptical. Now, you can't see it out there, but I want you to watch. Watch. There are 5 black notes on the piano. And those same 5 black notes just keep recurring. And you can go home tonight and play almost any Negro spiritual. Just play the black notes. Watch. You know that? Every time I feel the spirit, just black notes. Watch this. That's because the slaves didn't come to America with do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, di, do. That's somebody else's scale, okay? All they had in their musical scale were those 5 black notes. We know it in music as the pentatonic scale. And they built the power and pathos of the Negro spiritual on 5 notes. When you study music, you also come across what are known as white spirituals. Did you know that? And they are white composers who work with those that scale. In early America, they used to call this the slave scale. And I'm going to play for you what some musicologists think is the most famous white spiritual built on the slave scale or just the black notes. Oh. know who wrote that song? I heard it, a man by the name of John Newton. But do you know what John Newton did before he became a Christian? He was the captain of a slave ship. And many believe heard this melody that sounds very much like a West African sorrow chant, and wrote the words Amazing Grace and set his words to a slave melody. I looked up that song. I believe God wanted that song written just the way it was written, just so that we would be reminded that as Christians, whether black or white, free or bond, in his eyes, we're all connected. We are connected. And we are connected by God's amazing grace. Hallelujah! We are connected by God's amazing grace. I looked up that song in the Library of Congress. I went to the Library of Congress. I looked up that song. And wherever you see it authentically printed, you know what it says? Words, John Newton. Melody, unknown. I tell the Lord, when I get to heaven, I want to meet Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. But boy, I want to meet that slave called unknown. And I recorded that song the way I hear it. When I sing it, I still hear the sounds of the slave ships in the water. I want to sing it for you the way John Newton probably first heard it, coming up out of the belly of the ship.
what it heaven gonna be like. I don't know about you, but when I think of heaven, I'm excited because I got property up there. My D-A-D-D-Y with Jesus. Been with Jesus for 32 years. My mama been with the Lord for 28 years. And man, one day we all gonna be together one more time. Don't feel sorry for me. We got joy coming in the morning. And not only that, when I get to heaven, I'm going to have me a brand new body. I'm not going to walk with a limp. I'm not going to talk funny anymore. I'm going to walk and talk like Jesus. If you don't like the way I am, hang in there. I'm still in the oven. God's still in the kitchen. And God's still cooking on me. And when God get finished cooking on me, God going to pull me out of the oven. And God going to say, well done, good and faithful servant. But when I think of heaven, when I think of my mom and my dad, when I think of a brand new body, George, I can tie my own shoes. I can button my own shirt. What a day, glorious day, that will be. There is coming a day when no heartache shall come, no more clouds in the sky, no more tears to dim the eyes, all in peace forevermore. Oh, God. Big Colton Show. What a day. Glorious day. That will be. What a day. There will be no sorrow there, no more burden to bear, no more sickness, no pain, no party over there, and forever I will be with the one. Bill, can I come back? I got me a noon song.
to you.
Okay, welcome back here. I'm Dunny. Finally back. Get my Walmart readers. Almost lost track of that song to the end. We now know that Kinsey, for example, was deeply influenced by his work, by five pedophile headmasters who were quite clear they had very warm relationships with young adolescent boys of 12 or 13, one in New England area. Today, with many opportunities to eroticize schools and libraries, we must be concerned that adults who are helping children to understand their sexuality are actually pedophiles, or at least naive supporters, particularly as pornography seduces and habituates educated men and women. Children are increasingly at risk for this growing molester consistency. I did forget to say, Please support all the stations if you're able to, any, but especially use it. Consider the case of the president of Washington, D.C.'s American University, Richard Berendsen. Berendsen, Ph.D., was convicted of terrorizing women with obscene phone calls, requesting sex with their children, using pornography at his desktop. Berendsen called one woman claiming to have a 4-year-old sex slave caged in his basement. Forewarned by university authorities that the police were about to drag him off, Berendsen employed a standard legal dodge, fleeing to the Johns Hopkins sex clinic for treatment. In 3 weeks, therapists who shared the pedophile bias of the Johns Hopkins sex clinic founder, John Money, Ph.D., pronounced Berendsen recovered. Soon he returned to teach at AU students and now as an approved victim. He lectures at child protection conferences on his own early incest abuse. The heroic women who turned him in, an incest victim herself, had to move from her home without recourse or recovery from her presidential violation. Like most sexual psychopaths, Berendsen tried to protect himself by collecting men around him who had similar secrets or who were unquestionably obedient to authority. Not coincidentally, then, in 1986, 5 years before Berendsen's capture, a nine-year-old girl reported that the AU psychology department had Elliot McGinnis, Ph.D., molested her in his trailer at the Pine Tree Nudist Colony in Crownsville, Maryland. McGinnis also ran the legal dodge sprinting off to the mental health clinic before facing the courtroom. Eventually, he received a confusing sort of clearance from the local judge. With no explanation as to why the liberated nudist needed a quick therapy dose prior to his amnesty. Apparently, degrees in higher education do not necessarily restrain predatory child molesters. A major problem: educator sexual abuse has increased with the mainstreaming of pornographic stimuli. Clearly, we are in an era of serious sexual addiction and dysfunction, estimated by some as perhaps half of our male population and a smaller but significant number of our female population. Therefore, allowing any adult to provide any graphic sexual information to children places those children at risk. The educator who does so is suspect. There is no longer any justification for special rights for librarians to expose children to harmful matter. An informed and sophisticated distrust of anyone who represents such material to children is vital to the health and welfare of America's youth. Is everyone still awake? Newsflash: epidemic female teacher pedophiles. In 2005 through 2010, news about female teachers molesting students bombarded us. Although the number of male teacher molesters has rapidly increased in the internet years, the female pedophile epidemic is especially telling. This toxic flood law lays at the feet of sexual revolution and certainly at the mainstream pornography. Okay. On October 20th, 2005, Andy Decker raised useful questions about female teacher abusers in an internet essay on Free Republic, citing the Peoria Journal Star. Decker provided a list of such women, a coast-to-coast sample for those who work in public schools as bus drivers, substitutes, and full-time teachers. Many, if not most, of teachers are NEA members, he notes. These names only capture some of those charged from 2003 to 2009 of heterosexual and some homosexual abuse of vulnerable students. See teachercrime.com. The website itself indicates that it is not responsible for its content, nor does it. Nor does it validate the claims against the individuals listed on the site. So check press reports on the internet for local, national, and international updates on these charges to verify if the accused have been found innocent or guilty of the charges in the court of law. This is goes through a bunch of names here, probably about 50 of them. Andy Decker notes that the gross sexualization of our nation and the double standards is very light punishments for female pedophiles. Decker asks, what is the NEA's role in the flood of teacher abusers? What are the states doing about these public employees? What attention are we giving to this problem? Apparently not enough. On December 22, 2006, WorldNet Daily published a record of female pedophile teachers, starting with Stephanie Giambaluca, I guess that's the way it's pronounced. I'm not Italian. Sorry. Gianbeluca? I don't know. Police say the sexual abuse of the 12-year-old male student was recorded on videotape by the boy's babysitter. Here are a few of the examples. Amber Marshall, 23, Indiana teacher, confessed to sex with several high school students. Amy Gail Lilly, 36, Florida softball coach, 2 years of house arrest, and 8 years of probation for sex with 15-year-old girl. Angela Comer, 26, Kentucky, fled with the 14-year-old male student, pled guilty. Angela Stelweg, 24, a New Jersey mayor's daughter and substitute teacher, pled guilty to having sex in her apartment with a 14-year-old boy. Beth Raymond, 31, Connecticut private school employee, was sentenced to 8 months in prison for sexual assault of a juvenile male. Brandy Lynn Gonzalez, 27, Texas teacher, pled guilty to sexual assaulting 5 elementary school students with her husband, who pled guilty to sex acts with 1 teen. Camille Patch, 29, Utah substitute teacher, guilty of having sex with a 17-year-old high school male. She received no jail time. Laura J. Abzera, Bolingbrook, Illinois, elementary school nurse, confessed to sex with a boy. Jessica Bailey, Wishnask, North Carolina, middle school teacher, caught in the intimate contact with a boy. Tawny Wimberly, 29, Arizona technology teacher, pled guilty to sex with 2 male minors. Gay Turley, 42, Arizona PE teacher, softball coach, pled guilty to sex with a former girl student. Heather Chesser, 27, Tennessee, substitute teacher at alternate school, pled guilty to statutory rape of a boy student. Jennifer Matley, 27, Arizona, married English teacher, cheerleader, guilty of sex with a boy student. Carol Flanagan, 50, Florida, music teacher, convicted of sex with 11-year-old student and his father. Carrie McCandles, 29, Colorado, social studies teacher, married to the principal, pled guilty to sex with a boy. Kathy Hemingbus, 46, Missouri special ed teacher, convicted of statutory sodomy of 2 middle school boys students. Oh, good grief. There's another page and a half of this. I'm going to skip on by. For extensive January 2010 updates, see Women with Troubles. Identifying women arrested for child sexual abuse, including female teacher abusers, the use of pornography by educators and administrators, had been rampant for years. The pervasive acceptance of pornography is the elephant in the room, the toxins in the sexual waters. The tipping point for most, if not all, these predators. Consider these school reports of males and female predators. A school superintendent had an affair with the president of the parent-teacher organization, exchanging emails with sexual pictures of children. Let me check something out here. Yeah, I guess I'll read this. President of the Broward Teachers Union mailed internet pornography to the police officer posing as a 14-year-old girl. An Iowa middle school principal was arrested for child pornography and sexual exploitation of a minor. A New Jersey school superintendent was arrested for sexually explicit internet conversations with what he thought was a 13-year-old girl. You know, I've thought over the years here, I don't know how many years it's been, but they have this this technology on the cell phones and some of these other Snapchats and Instagrams and all that stuff that makes people look younger. I seen something just a couple of weeks ago that there was a sting. A 36-year-old woman was posing as a 12-year-old girl, and they changed her face from 36 back to 12. And the guy got caught. He, I guess they sent him off to jail. She actually went to meet the guy, and then they ended up stinging him and arresting him. So I think that's pretty cool, some of that stuff is, anyways. They can use that to catch these people. A college professor was arrested for distributing thousands of child pornography images on the internet, pandering obscenity involving a minor, promoting prostitution, unauthorized use of property, wiretapping, and tampering with evidence. A Wisconsin teacher was arrested for child enticement and solicitation for using the internet to arrange a sexual encounter with a police officer posing as a 14-year-old girl. Yeah, this was in 2009 or 10, though. This one I'm talking about is just recently here within the last year. A Massachusetts high school teacher engaged in online sex acts after recruiting teenage girls to watch him. A Maryland drama teacher was indicted for child pornography. An Orange County, California school bus driver was convicted December 2009 of molesting and taking pornographic photos of three girls. Scores of school bus drivers have been arrested for child pornography. One in Maryland was charged with sodomy, aggravated sexual abuse, and endangering the welfare of a child. An Oklahoma Sunday school teacher got over 24 years in prison for internet-associated sex crimes against minors. Sex abuse at the Premier American Boy Chair School in Trenton, New Jersey, was so persuasive that administrators who sodomized male students thought molestation produced a world-class choir, according to a lawyer for a former victim. A former Warwick High School coach allegedly seduced and had sex with a 15-year-old girl at his home when his wife and children were out. An elementary school educator in Virginia was charged with having images of nude youth and using his computer to solicit children. Child pornography was found on a California math teacher's home computer. Chapter 11, Sabotaging Schools and Libraries. I'm going to get a quick drink here. Chapter 11, Sabotaging Schools and Libraries. Banned Books Week is not a celebration of free speech. It's a way of left-wing bureaucrats to bully ordinary citizens by stigmatizing those who complained with nasty names such as bigots, screamers, and book burners. The purpose of is to intimidate parents from ever complaining about books that are given to their own children. Phyllis Schlafly. Eagle Forum, December 4, 2009. Sabotaging Your Public Library, a tax-paid peep show. Schools are not the only place where child sex abuse is prevalent, and teachers are not the only predators. Conservative leaders like attorney and former public school teacher Phyllis Schlafly have long argued that our libraries were under the control of sexual saboteurs, men and women who sought to overturn parental rights in favor of those of leftist revolutionaries. Schools are not the only place where child sex... All of our lives, most of us have gone to public schools, finding them wholly safe and friendly environments. However, due to the forceful defense of pedophile rights by members of the American Library Association, child molesters now feel free to carry on their activities in our public libraries. One paroled pedophile crawled under a library table and molested a 6-year-old girl at a Spokane, Washington public library. Her father had walked away to get her first library card. Typically, the predator's lawyer argued that the convicted child molester needed more treatment. He will serve at least 15 years. That's not enough treatment, actually. He needs lead treatment. That's what he needs. The ALA has battled all attempts by sane, independent-minded Americans to reinstate laws that will protect our rights to a safe and civilized public library that includes known psychopaths. We might ponder how the righteous librarian with the horn-rimmed glasses degenerated into a peep show proprietor. Well, I tell you, she didn't, because my 84-year-old aunt still works at a library 3 to 4 days a week, and she doesn't like it, I'm sure. I'm sure she knows about it. She's been there like 30-some-odd years. The NEA and the ALA refuse to self-police. So, in 2000, Congress passed the Children's Internet Protection Act, which requires schools and libraries to use filtering software to block Internet material considered obscene or harmful to minors. The U.S. Supreme Court reaffirmed the law against a challenge in 2003. Those who refuse to comply, as some librarians do, have lost significant federal funding for their communities. Based on free speech, they defend their actions despite direct harm to children and to the general community. Defending pornography rights as standard Keynesian education, which the librarians received in their college educations. But of course, big pornography has rewarded the ALA leaders who protect their sexual secrets for its support for years. The pornography industry, the sex industrial complex, has publicly funded the ALA, which is also a member of the Media Coalition, also funded by big pornography. On the evidence, these entities have conflicts of interest between their duty to society and their fiduciary duty to big pornography. Given the incestuous relationships between these organizations, it is no surprise that the ALA often acts as a friend of pornographers in court cases. In New York versus Ferber, for example, the ALA fought for Ferber, a child pornography distributor, arguing that filming for profit child sexual abuse qualified as freedom of expression. This was not an isolated effort. In 1994, the ALA again pleaded for Big Pornography's right to sexually exploit children. The United States District of Columbia Court of Appeals repudiated this case. The ALA Playboy NAMBLA connection. 1993, San Francisco's ALA allowed the North American Man Boy Love Association, NAMBLA, to use a library room as a meeting place for their regular monthly meetings. The local television station, KRON, broadcast a report by Greg Lyon, who noted the NAMBLA mission is to help their members safely meet and molest children. We're talking about children as young as 3 years old, according to KRON's report. The San Francisco Public Library on Saturday afternoon, downstairs, children, some with parents, some by themselves. And upstairs, this scene captured by our Target 4 hidden camera. This is a regular monthly meeting of NAMBLA, North American Man Boy Love Association. This is not a counseling session, not a attempt to help NAMBLA members control their lust for children. Quite the opposite. On this day, the group discussed putting together a calendar of nude boys for a fundraiser. Lending our tax-funded facilities and the ALA's considerable prestige to aid pederasts and child pornographers reveals the ALA leader's commitment to normalize a historically anti-American culture standard. Adult sexual assault of children, preventing free speech for predators, or a safe environment for their victims. Freedom to read or freedom to rape. And I'm going to get another drink here. Second. The ALA refused to filter criminal violent obscenity, even from children. And even despite a mandate from legislators for years, the ALA's pornographer elite has controlled our libraries and librarians. For example, and no doubt influencing ALA's support of pornographers in scores of judicial cases, Playboy has given substantial donations to the American Libraries Association, Freedom to Read Foundation for substantiation, see a look at the Playboy Foundation's record. When the ALA works to bring harmful matter produced by one of its financial patrons to our libraries, a significant conflict of interest is obvious. For example, the ALA defended using children of all ages in the most vile obscenity as the Ferber case. The ALA defended Playboy via its Freedom to Read Foundation. In the 1996 case, Playboy versus the United States. In service to their pornographic patrons, the ALA rode roughshod over the public interest with the Freedom to Read Foundation, while the American people were trying to eliminate Signal Bleed, the partial reception of pornographic cable television shows in the homes of non-subscribers to that programming, that the ALA is in direct conflict with the majority of the taxpaying public is visible by the hostile reactions of the polity of the ALA. effort to turn our public libraries into local dirty bookstore monopolies. Are children safe in public libraries? No, not at all safe. What normal person would use a library computer to view pornography? I thought it was against the law. I thought they had filters on that stuff for the computers. And where do they take their arousal? On January 11, 2010, even the San Francisco Chronicle reported, the bathrooms often have proved downright scary, with people doing drugs, bathing in the sinks, and having sex in the stalls. But the library has, well, begun to turn the page on the problem by hiring what is believed to be the country's first full-time psychiatric social worker stationed in the public library to watch the bathrooms. How civilized. On Point, Safe Libraries also reported suggestions by a reporter from January 9, 2010 that patrons have been caught performing sex acts in the library bathrooms and between library stacks, always bringing hand sanitizer when visiting the computer lab. People are viewing pornography on these computers and, well, masturbating. Library staff rarely ever cleans the keyboards, and mice are in the computer labs, so they are nasty. So, if using library computers, please bring hand sanitizers. Education. Realistically, computers are so inexpensive now that only the most out-of-control predators would risk using pornography in the public library. The fact remains that non-filtered libraries do attract predators. For example, a paroled pedophile used the Grand Rapids, Michigan library to email nude photos of himself to a 14-year-old girl. A Pell City Board of Education, Alabama, Chamber of Commerce chairman used a Homewood public library to access child pornography. A Chicago paroled pedophile downloaded child pornography from computers at the West Hills Public Library and returned to download more child pornography. A 55-year-old Chicago librarian was found with a suitcase of computer-generated images of children as young as 6 years performing various sexual acts. Bring your own laptop. Just connect to the Wi-Fi or hardwire connect. A paroled predator was caught downloading pornography at a Paris, California library. A twice-convicted incest child molester left his resume and child pornography in the bathroom at a Cleveland public library. In 2006, CBS Broadcasting reported 36 sex crimes were committed at Chicago's Harold Washington Library alone in the last 3 years. At Chicago libraries, we could actually see a patron looking at porn simply by standing on a city street and looking through the window. Oh, good grief. Obviously, pedophiles, including known sex offenders, access pornography and look for child victims in our public libraries. In 2003, the ALA encouraged librarians to reject the Children's Internet Protection Act that would protect children from library pornography and get their funds elsewhere. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld the CIPA in June 23, 2003, allowing budgets to be withheld absent blocking software. The 6-3 Supreme Court ruling held that the CIPA does not violate the First Amendment because public libraries do not offer internet access. 2, create a public forum for web publishers, but to facilitate research, learning, and recreational pursuits by furnishing materials of requisite and appropriate quality. As to filters, tendency to block constitutionally protected speech, the then Chief Justice William H. Rehnquist wrote that because SIPA allows librarians to disable a filter without significant delay of an adult user's request, the goal of protecting young library users from material inappropriate for minors outweighs any temporary inconvenience to adults. Well, I think I'll end this segment of the show right here and come back after a song with Judson Witham, guest for an hour, as long as I can reach him. So let me see here. I think about a 4.5 minute song. I can find my mouse. Be right back in just a few minutes, everyone.